remember from our previous talk that we said these are the two tracks or the two pathways that you want to know very well. So today we have quite a few objectives to get through. It's not the three that we saw in the first lecture, but we'll be able to get through all of these objectives. So we saw in our first or our introductory lecture that for us to perform a motor activity that is mediated by the cortical bulbar or corticospinal tract, we involve volition or will or choice. And that is done by our prefrontal cortex, as we saw. That information is fed into our premotor cortex, where we have the programmed information for the particular activity. Then that gets into the precentral gyrus, where we have our primary motor cortex, and the necessary muscles are recruited, and the activity is carried out. So as we continue our discussion, I just have this question for you. Okay, so this question is asking us which fibers have the greatest influence on our lower motor neuron, or which particular area has the greatest influence on our lower motor neurons as it relates to carrying out a particular function. And let's see what you guys thought. Right, so 73% of you thought it was the primary motor cortex. That is true. Your primary motor cortex has the greatest influence on your lower motor neurons. But as we will see in the upcoming slides, these are the areas that we have listed here also contribute towards motor activity. So your primary motor cortex, where do we find it? We know that it's basically made up of your precentral gyrus and your anterior paracentral lobule. Now, as you study the motor system and you appreciate the location of the primary motor cortex, it's also important to appreciate what blood vessels supply your primary motor cortex. So as it relates to your precentral gyrus, what would be the blood vessel that contributes towards this area, your precentral gyrus? I'm just hearing voices, no words. Your middle cerebral. So your precentral gyrus would be supplied by your middle cerebral, and your anterior paracentral lobule would be supplied by your anterior cerebral. So keep that in mind. Good. As it relates to the somatotopic organization of your primary motor cortex, here we're looking at the homunculus. So we know that the homunculus is basically the body's representation on your motor cortex. You have a sensory homunculus and we have a motor homunculus, and this, today, of course, we're looking at the motor homunculus. So you should know that the lateral aspects of your brain, as it relates to the primary motor cortex, would be responsible for what particular areas of your body. So for example, let's say I have a patient who has motor deficits in the lower limbs. What part of the primary motor cortex am I looking at? Am I looking at the precentral gyrus or the anterior paracentral lobule? The anterior paracentral lobule, because that region is responsible for the motor activities of the lower limb. So if someone has a motor deficit of the lower limb and you're asked to find the blood vessel that's most likely associated with that, what would be the answer? Your anterior artery. Okay, so as it relates to your corticospinal fibers, we know that they originate in the cortex and then they're going to project towards the spinal cord and the brainstem. Now, where exactly do they arise from? They arise from the pyramidal cells in layer 5 of your cortex. And then they're going to project towards the brainstem if we're talking about the corticobulbar fibers, or they're going to project towards the spinal cord if we're talking about the corticospinal fibers. Now, this diagram shows us the many areas that are implicated in motor activity. So for your primary somatosensory cortex, which is Brodmann's area 312, as you know, this contributes towards motor activity because it relays sensory information to the primary motor cortex. So it allows the primary motor cortex to be informed about the sensory, about the environment in which we are carrying out a particular activity. So if we are going to walk bare feet, yeah, and something actually pricks you, you'll know not to step too hard on that particular thing, because your somatosensory cortex is going to be relaying that information to your motor cortex, so you're not going to step too intensely on that particular object. You also have information coming from your limbic region. Now, this is going to be in terms of impulses that control movement. So, do I feel like moving my hand? All right? So, if I do feel like moving my hand, or if I don't feel like moving my hand, that information is going to be relayed to your prefrontal cortex. All right? So, I feel like doing it. It is relayed to the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex then is going to relay that information to your premotor cortex, where you have your programmed activity stored, and then that is going to be relayed to your primary motor cortex. Okay? So remember the last lecture I was telling you that I was thinking about probably doing a dance to demonstrate some aspect of the of the motor activity concept. All right? So that was, I felt like doing it, but I chose not to do it. All right? So that information was relayed to my prefrontal cortex, and my better judgment said, you know what, I probably shouldn't do it. All right? But if I did decide to do it, well, then I would have depended on my pre-motor cortex to pull up some of those wonderful dance moves that I would have learned sometime in the past. And then that particular area would have relayed that information to my primary motor cortex to recruit the specific muscles I needed to flex or extend or rotate or whatever it is that I wanted to do. Okay? Now, your posterior parietal cortex that you see here in green, we see that this particular location, is receiving input from your visual cortex, which is in your occipital lobe, and information from your temporal lobe. And then that information is being relayed to our premotor cortex. So we see that vision and auditory information has a very important role as it relates to motor activity. So for example, let me see all those who know to play cricket here. Cricket? Cricket? You know where you have a bat and a ball? Yes, the game cricket. Yes. Or you see it played. All right? I see some hands there. Some people may know to play baseball or some other game where you have to look at a ball coming to you, then time that ball, and then choose to swing in the appropriate timing. Okay? So for that to happen, I need my visual cortex to tell me when to swing. Okay? So your visual cortex is going to relay that information to your posterior parietal area. Then that is relayed to my premotor cortex or my premotor area. Now, why does it need to be relayed to my premotor area? Because I need that information. I need a programmed activity. If you don't know to bat, well, then you won't be able to carry out that particular activity. Okay? So it goes to the premotor area where you have the program stored for batting or whatever particular activity it is. Then that informs our primary motor cortex and the particular activity is carried out. Even though the basal ganglia is not represented in this image, and the cerebellum, as we spoke about in the previous lectures, these areas are responsible for modulating the activity so that it is smooth and purposeful. And we'll talk about that in a few slides coming. All right. Okay, so this is talking about our subcortical influences, and that's what we were talking about earlier as it relates to the basal ganglia and the cerebellum. So after the information would have come from your premotor cortex, that program activity, it goes to your primary motor cortex, and the primary motor cortex is then going to relay that information to the basal ganglia and the cerebellum. As we said, the cerebellum is responsible for modulating movement while it is in motion. So as you're batting that ball, as you're swinging, your cerebellum is making sure that you're swinging in a smooth and purposeful fashion, and that you're also adjusting it based on the sensory information that is coming in. All right? So do I need to move the bat up? Do I need to move it down? Do I need to turn my body a little more? Do I need to duck because it's going to hit me in my head? All right? So all of that is is going to help. The cerebellum is going to help you in all of that activity. Your basal ganglia is also going to be important for modulating your activity in terms of making it smooth and purposeful. So once this information goes to the cerebellum and the basal ganglia, and they modulate that particular activity, how is the information relayed back to the motor cortex? Via the thalamus, as we can see here. So the thalamus has a very important role to play in modulating motor activity. If we injure the thalamus, we will not be able to get the modulatory information from the basal ganglia and the cerebellum back to the primary motor cortex. So when that information then goes back to the primary motor cortex, we can now carry out our activity, whether it's via the cortical bulbar fibers that are going to terminate at the brainstem, or the corticospinal fibers that will terminate on the spinal cord. So we continue talking about the primary motor cortex and the premotor cortex. So as it relates here, premotor cortex, you have a medial area that's called the supplemental area, and that is principally involved in plan sequences. And then we have a lateral premotor area involved in sensory guided movements. All right, and we talked about sensory guided movements a little bit earlier when we said the ball's coming and you need to adjust. So your premotor area is going to help you with those particular activities. Now what we're seeing here on this diagram is what areas we utilize for a particular activity. So the activity that they have here in the example is finger flexion. So in this diagram here for finger flexion, we see that we're utilizing the primary motor cortex and our somatosensory cortex. So your somatosensory cortex, as I said before, is going to give your motor system information as it relates to the sensory environment. It's also going to tell us about proprioception, where our joints are in time and space. Okay, so if you're flexing your finger, even if you're closing your eyes, your brain knows that the finger is flexing because of the somatosensory information that is coming in. Yeah? Now we see here the supplementary motor area, as we said before, is responsible for planned motor sequences. So as you're flexing your finger, you have your supplementary motor area being utilized. Now you can perform a motor activity mentally, not so? So right now you can imagine running on the beach, not so? Yes. Now, when that happens, we are going to disengage or disconnect our primary motor cortex from our premotor cortex. So as we think about running on the beach, yes, that's a learned motor activity. So therefore, we are going to utilize our primary motor cortex as we think about that activity. But because we're not actually carrying it out, you are going to disengage your primary motor cortex because you're not actually recruiting those muscles. So your prefrontal area is going to help you to basically disconnect those two areas so you can think about it and not actually recruit the muscles to carry out the particular activity. So now that we've talked about the origin of our cortical bulbar and corticospinal tracts, we can look at the rest of the pathway. We already talked about the homunculus, the motor homunculus, in which our lower limbs is represented on the medial aspect of the brain, and our upper limbs and face and trunk is represented on the lateral aspect of the motor cortex. And so this is where we're going to begin in Brodmann's area 4. From there, where do we go? So from our primary motor cortex, we are going to project to our corona radiata, and we see that in red, all right? So those fibers are going to project towards the corona radiata. Then they're going to move through the internal capsule, as we can see here. Then they get to the crus cerebri, or what we call our cerebral peduncles. And from there, they're going to get into the pons. Now, it's important to note the arrangement of your corticospinal and corticobulbar fibers in the internal capsule. So if we have a lesion to the internal capsule, what structures are going to be affected? So here we have the posterior limb of the internal capsule. That's where we have arm, trunk, leg being labeled. And as you notice, the arrangement of these fibers. So we have our arm medially followed by the trunk and the leg being most laterally oriented. So therefore, if we have an injury to the posterior limb of the internal capsule, depending on the extent of that injury, these areas can be affected. All right, So we went through the crus cerebri, or the cerebellar peduncles, which is in the midbrain. We then go through the anterior aspects of the pons, and then we get to the pyramids. And as you know, your pyramids would be the most anterior aspect of the medulla. So all this time, the fibers are running ipsilaterally. It's running on the same side. Now, the lateral corticospinal tract, as you know, accounts for about 90% of your corticospinal tract, while the anterior corticospinal tract or the anterior corticospinal fibers account for the other 10%. It is important to note that your anterior corticospinal fibers, as we said, they do not, I'm not sure why that diagram is looking that way, but they do not decussate, all right? They remain on the same side, while your lateral corticospinal fibers, they are going to decussate or cross over to the other side, and we'll see that in a bit. So just reviewing what we've said so far, so we're going to be moving from the primary motor cortex, that's Brodmann's area 4, we get down through the corona radiata into the internal capsule, crus cerebri, we move through the pons, and then we get into the pyramids of the medulla, where we have decussation taking place. All right. So at the pyramids, we'll have the fibers, the lateral corticospinal fibers, crossing over onto the opposite side. And please note that we're still talking about our upper motor neurons at this point. So this is the region, the lower aspect of the medulla, that's where we have the decussation of our lateral corticospinal fibers taking place. So the fibers that are coming from the right side of the brain are going to move towards the left, and the fibers that are coming from the left side of the brain are going to move towards the right side. Now that we've discussed that, we can reflect again on our upper and lower motor neurons. So all that we've spoke about earlier was related to the upper motor neuron aspect of our corticospinal, corticobulbar fiber. So until the decussation takes place, we're talking about upper motor neurons. So if we have an injury to these fibers as they project towards the spinal cord before the decussation, what will we see? We will see hyperreflexia. What does that mean? It means that our reflexes will be exaggerated. We will see an extensor plantar response, which is also known as the Babinski response, and you'll learn more about this in your small groups. You'll actually have a chance to practice this on your patients, on the standardized patients. Then there's clonus, and we'll see an example of what clonus is, basically a rhythmic movement. Then we'll see flaccid paralysis and spastic paralysis. Now, the flaccid paralysis, you would see that with spinal shock. Let me take a minute to just explain that quickly. Now, someone who has injury to the upper motor neurons in the spinal cord, initially, at the initial insult, you're going to see a flaccid paralysis. Now, a flaccid paralysis, as you should know, or as you will know and in the next slide, is associated with a lower motor neuron disease, okay? But with the initial injury of the spinal cord that affects your upper motor neurons, the initial picture that you see is a flaccid paralysis. And after about 4 weeks, this is the picture here that you will see your hyperreflexia, extensor plantar response, clonus, and then the flaccid paralysis becomes spastic in nature. You understanding? So what I want to say with all of that is that your upper motor neuron disease will give you a spastic paralysis. But in the initial onset, or the initial injury, what you see is a flaccid paralysis. So if a patient presents with a flaccid paralysis, you can't use that alone to say that the patient has an upper motor neuron disease without imaging and without waiting to see what's going to happen. So all of these signs you will see when the patient has an upper motor neuron disease, and the signs are usually contralateral to the lesion. if it's basically above it. So if the lesion is above the decussation, you'll see the signs contralateral to the lesion, and if the lesion is below the decussation, we'll see the signs ipsilateral to the lesion. Is that clear? So this is an example of clonus. Okay, so it's not working, but I can demonstrate it for you. So someone who has upper motor neuron disease, you can check for clonus by extending the limb. So you can use the foot or you can use the hands. If you extend it, the patient usually has this rhythmic flapping like that. That is uncontrolled or involuntary. And that is clonus. Now, a lower motor neuron disease, these signs are ipsilateral to the lesion. Very important. So for your lower motor neuron disease, the signs are always ipsilateral, while for your upper motor neuron disease, it depends on if the lesion is above the decussation or if it's below the decussation. So what will you see? You will see hyporeflexia. So your reflexes are depressed. You can also see areflexia or an absent reflex. We have decreased tone, hypotonia, fasciculations. These are visible muscle twitches. Fibrillations you cannot appreciate with the eye. And then you can also notice atrophy, which is known as wasting. I'm not sure if this is going to work. All right. So if you look at the hand, you can see that the tenor eminence looks very flattened. And even all the hypotenor eminence seems very flattened. So this patient has wasting of the muscles in the hand. And this is classical for a low motor neuron disease. So now that we've discussed the origin and the pathway for the corticobulbar, corticospinal fibers, and we've talked about what signs and symptoms we can see in patients who have upper and low motor neuron disease, let's look at a few clinical correlations that help us to put the picture together. We begin by looking at Brown-Séquard syndrome, and I know that you would have done this already in your sensory systems, but as you should know, it also has a motor component to it. Now, your Brown-Séquard syndrome arises from a hemisection of the spinal cord, and that hemisection can be due to traumatic or non-traumatic causes, but it's usually traumatic in nature. And it results in the damage of our three long tracts. So we have two ascending tracts, our dorsal column, medial meniscus, our spinothalamic tract, and of course our corticospinal tracts. And that gives us our classical findings that we see in Brown-Séquard syndrome. So we'll begin by looking at what happens to the corticospinal tract. So here we see the upper motor neuron fibers descending from the cortex through corona radiata internal capsule. Then we get to the crustacerebri through the pons. Then we get into the pyramid, and the fibers decussate. All right? So here we see that the insult is happening after decussation. Therefore, we will see the symptoms ipsilateral to the site of lesion because the injury is after the decussation. What symptoms will we see? We will see upper motor neuron disease because we're injuring the corticospinal tract and not the lower motor neuron, which is represented in red. So we will see hyperreflexia, the extensor plantar response, spastic paralysis, and this spastic paralysis, of course, will appear after about 4 weeks. That's after the initial insult. So these are the findings that we will see as it relates to the corticospinal tract. All right, so if we have a lesion on this side, as we saw in the previous slide, if we have a lesion on the left side, our right-sided fibers are not affected, okay? Therefore, we will not see any symptoms on the right side, okay? So there's no impairments on the contralateral side. So will you have a lower motor neuron disease, or a lower motor neuron symptom, I should say, in Brown-Séquard syndrome? Yes, you will. Now, the lower motor neuron symptoms will be seen just at the level of the lesion, because you're injuring the ventral horn cells at that level of the spinal cord. So let's say that the lesion is at T6, you are going to see lower motor neuron symptoms at the T6 level of the myotome. So what will you see? You will see hypo or areflexia, wasting of those muscles associated with that level of the spinal cord, flaccid paralysis affecting those levels, those muscles associated with that level of the spinal cord, and fasciculation, fibrillation at that particular level also. Below that, you will not see lower motor neuron symptoms because the ventral horn cells will be spared. It's only at that particular level where you have the insult that you will see the lower motor neuron symptoms. So now that we've covered the corticospinal tract, let's just review what's going to happen with the spinothalamic tract. I know that you would have done this in your sensory system lectures. So if we have an insult, as we saw on the left side, we will see no effect towards the ipsilateral side that's below the level of the lesion. All right, so we see no effect there. But as it relates to the contralateral side, we know that our spinothalamic fibers, they decussate, all right, at the level that they come in, they decussate via the anterior white commissure, and they travel up. So we are going to lose perception of pain and temperature on the contralateral side below the level of the lesion. And because of your Lesser's tract, of course, you know that the pain and temperature impairment will be 2 to 3 levels below the level of the lesion. And I know that you covered this in extent in your sensory lectures. What's going to happen with your dorsal column medullary meniscus? So this particular tract does not decussate as we see in our ALS or our spinothalamic tract. So we are going to see ipsilateral deficits as it relates to the dorsal column medullary meniscus. We're going to lose perception of vibration and proprioception on the side of the injury. Now, Christopher Reeves, we all know him, or we should all know him. I'm not sure if you're old enough to know him. All right. So he was a successful actor, and everybody knows him as Superman. And we know that he had a very a terrible injury that caused him to develop paraplegia, and he was paralyzed from the neck down, and eventually he succumbed to heart failure. So that brings us into our discussion of paraplegia, and paraplegia occurs because of bilateral spinal cord injury. So unlike Brongstad syndrome, where we only had one side of the spinal cord affected, the left side or the right side and hemisection, with complete spinal cord transection, we have both sides of the spinal cord affected. So what are we going to see? So unlike what we saw in Brongstad syndrome, we are going to affect both sides of our body. We're going to affect both the right side and the left side as it relates to our corticospinal tract, because it's a complete transection, or you're having injury on both sides of the spinal cord. So the upper motor neuron symptoms will be seen on the right side, and it will be seen on the left side. And of course, your lower motor neuron symptoms will only be seen at that particular level of the injury. So as we said earlier, with the initial insult, you're going to see a flaccid paralysis, and that is because of the spinal shock. But after about 4 weeks, the spastic paralysis will develop. We have our increased deep tendon reflexes along with clonus, so that's hyperreflexia. Along with clonus, you will see your extensor plantar response, or what's called your Babinski response, because that's characteristic for upper motor neuron diseases. All right, you can have retention of urine with painless distension of the bladder. Now, this is a feature of spinal shock, which will recover after about the 4 to 6 weeks. And also we're gonna interrupt our spinothalamic and our dorsal column medial meniscus, so we will have somatosensory deficits bilaterally. Now what's gonna happen if we have an infarction to the internal capsule? We saw earlier that our corticospinal and corticobulbar fibers usually travel through the internal capsules as they move towards the brainstem for the corticobulbar fibers and the spinal cord for the corticospinal fibers. So because it's above the decussation and we're injuring the corticospinal or corticobulbar fibers, we will have an upper motor neuron deficit. Will we see lower motor neuron signs? Do you think we're going to see lower motor neuron signs here if we have an injury to the internal capsule? No, not at all, because we're not in the spinal cord. We're not affecting the ventral horn. So this is going to be a purely upper motor neuron syndrome. And because the fibers have not yet decussated, we are going to see the symptoms represented on the contralateral side of the body. As you can see, these fibers are moving towards the opposite side of the body. So you'll see the classical hyperreflexia, extensor response, spastic paralysis, and so on and so forth. All right, so we did say it's going to give us a contralateral hemiplegia. No, because we're affecting corticobulbar fibers also, and we know corticobulbar fibers are responsible for influencing cranial nerves, we will see cranial nerve deficits too. So what deficits can we see? We'll see deviation of the tongue towards the side. We'll see deviation of the tongue towards the side of weakness, and hence away from the side of the lesion. So usually, all right, so if you have an injury to this side of your brain, your tongue moves contralateral to the lesion. Contralateral to the lesion, okay? It's unlike what you learned. Did you learn about lower motor neuron lesions for the tongue? You'll see the tongue moving towards the side of the lesion. You learned that? The tongue licks its wounds? Yes? Good. So that's what you see with low motor neuron damage. But here, with injury to the internal capsule, we are talking about an upper motor neuron damage to the corticobulbar fibers that are influencing the movement of the tongue, okay? So the deficit will be different as compared to what we see in the lower motor neuron disease. We'll also affect gaze, all right? So gaze palsy towards the side of the lesion. So you look, the eye looks towards the lesion as it is described. And you'll have facial deficits, all right, affecting the lower half of the face. And we'll talk about that in concert as we move down. So let's look at the genioglossus muscle. And the genioglossus muscle is responsible for projection of the tongue. All right, as you project it, it moves out, and it's central unless you decide to move it to the left or to the right. So you have your fibers, and we know the tongue is represented on this aspect of the homunculus, towards the just above the temporal lobe. We see the fibers are going to descend through the internal capsule, through crustacerebri, pons, then they decussate to influence our genioglossus muscle. All right, so this is going to be a hypoglossal nerve, and the hypoglossal nerve is going to innervate the genioglossus muscle. So once everything is working, the tongue should be centrally located, unless you choose to deviate it to the left side or the right side. But if we have an injury to the internal capsule on the right side, what is going to happen? So let's see. So we have interrupted our fibers that are coming from the right side of the brain to influence our left hypoglossal nerve, okay? So therefore, if I have an injury of my right corticobulbar fibers that influence my tongue movement, right side, so I have an injury here, my tongue is going to move to the contralateral side, okay? Now this slide shows you what happens if you have a lower motor neuron lesion. So here we notice that the injury is not affecting the corticobulbar fibers, but now it's affecting the lower motor neuron fibers via the hypoglossal nerve. So we do not have any innervation of the genioglossus muscle via the left hypoglossal nerve. So that's going to basically cause the tongue to deviate towards the side of the lesion, and this is what you would have learned earlier. All right, so this slide basically shows you the difference between central and a peripheral lesion affecting the genioglossus muscle. Gaze palsy, what's going to happen? So we have our corticobulbar fibers descending, and if it is interrupted on the left side, well, then we will not be able to influence our, if it's interrupted on the right side, well, then we will not be able to influence our right eye, all right? And therefore, you're going to have a gaze palsy that's looking towards the side of the lesion. So what you want to remember here is with cortical lesions, your eye looks towards the lesion. How are we going to affect the facial nerve? So fibers from the cortex are going to descend through the internal capsule. Then they get to the facial nucleus. So here we see innervation from the right side of the brain is going to influence our left side of the face. We also have fibers from the ipsilateral side innervating the left side of the face, and that is true for the upper face. So the upper face is innervated by both sides of the brain. Okay? Sorry. The lower face, however, only has influence from the contralateral side of the brain. So if we have a lesion on the right side of the brain, we are going to spare the left upper face. All right? Because we still have innervation from this side of the brain. But the lower face is going to be affected. Therefore, if you have an upper motor neuron, this is basically saying if you have an upper motor neuron lesion affecting the cortical bulbar fibers that influence the facial nerve, well, then we're going to see our deficits on the lower aspect of the face. Is that clear? So if you have an upper, so the rule is upper spares upper. So if you have an upper motor neuron damage of your cortical bulbar fibers that influence your facial nerve, we are going to spare the upper part of the face. So this patient is still going to be able to wrinkle their brows. They're going to be able to wrinkle the brows on both sides of the face. But if we have a lesion affecting the lower motor neurons, and here we're talking about the facial nerve proper, well, then we are affecting the fibers that go to the upper and the lower aspect of the face, even though the integrity of the cortical bulbar fibers has not been affected. So therefore, this patient will not be able to wrinkle their eyebrows, and they will not be able to utilize the muscles in the lower aspect of their face. So with a lower motor neuron lesion affecting the facial nerve, we're going to see complete weakness on one side of the face. With an upper motor neuron lesion, as we said, upper spares upper. Okay, so this is a very simple question, and after this lengthy discussion, I'm sure that all of you were able to get it right. Let's see if my prediction is correct. All right, so most of you are able to get the right answer. That's good. And those of you who were not, I'm sure as you review the information, you'll be able to capture the point that the question is trying to get at. So injury to the cortical bulbar fibers. Your cortical bulbar fibers, are they upper motor neuron in nature or lower motor neuron in nature? their upper motor neuron in nature. So injury to the cortical bulbar fiber will result in an upper motor neuron lesion. So you will see upper motor neuron symptoms. Same thing with injury to the cortical spinal fibers. You will see upper motor neuron symptoms. Okay? If we're talking about injury to the facial nerve or to the ulnar nerve or to any of the lower motor neurons, well, then we will talk about a lower motor neuron lesion. Okay? So this is the last slide. You can take your 10-minute break and we'll return to discuss. Okay. Hi.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.